Publishers were among those applauding this week when the Supreme Court upheld a 1998 law that extended the term of copyright. Unlike the motion picture and record industries, which also depend on copyright protection, publishers have so far been immune to large-scale copying of their products on the Internet. Nonetheless, they're taking steps to make sure that once books are delivered in electronic form, there's no Napster for readers. NPR's Rick Carr reports.
So far, the book has proved to be a resilient form of technology. Nobody's yet developed an electronic book that readers find superior to old-fashioned ink on paper. But that day isn't far off, according to Pat Schroeder, the former U.S. representative from Colorado who's now president of the Association of American Publishers. She says members of the association hope that the day comes soon because it'd save them money. Delivering books electronically means no more paper or ink, no more trucks or warehouses. And Schroeder says it'll also be a great day for readers.
If they don't want the whole book, they don't have to buy the whole book. If they want three chapters, they pay for three chapters. Say you're taking a trip. You may want two chapters out of one travel book, a chapter out of something else, your favorite poems from someone about that. You may want some information on cooking. You just put that all together in your own little digital product. But you pay for the bits and pieces that you assemble.
The downside of digital literature, according to Schroeder, is that computers and the internet allow readers to make perfect copies of electronic books, then distribute them to whomever they want. She says that could cause problems at the local lending library.
Checking out?
Yes, I need to return this one first. Okay. Sorry. Thanks.
Casey Danielson works behind the counter at the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library in downtown Washington, D.C. He says one of the attractions of the place is that it lets readers get books for free.
There's a lot of people who get philosophy books and art books, and that's actually one of the great things. You get the huge $300 art folio books that you could never buy, and they're free.
Pat Schroeder says a public lending library full of electronic books looks an awful lot like Napster, the online service that let users share their music collections with one another.
If suddenly you say when a library buys one digital copy, they can then give it to the world, we can visualize a world where you would sell one digital copy and that would be it. So you suddenly have a cyber candy store and everything is free. It would be a very short-term candy store, and librarians understand this. You know, reasonable people all understand that.
But many librarians take issue with Schroeder and the publishers. Nancy Cronick is past president of the American Library Association. She says libraries have the right to lend books to the public under a provision of U.S. copyright law known as the First Sale Doctrine.
And that allows us to actually physically purchase a book, for example, and we can do anything we want with that book. We can check it out, we can catalog it, we can discard it, we might sell it in a book sale, we can do a lot of things to it.
As can anyone who buys a book today. But Cronick says under recent changes to copyright law that were supported by film studios, record companies, and publishers, those rights are disappearing.
Basically, the copyright laws for digital don't really recognize the first sale doctrine. So libraries can't do the same kind of loaning of the material. And most of the materials we're getting electronically, we're signing licensing agreements for.
For instance, Cronick says, when a library buys an electronic book or magazine subscription, a publisher might stipulate that library users cannot print pages, or that the material cannot be loaned to another library. Cronick says rights that were once a matter of public policy are increasingly governed by private contracts. Pat Schroeder says that's the way it should be. Publishers should be allowed to do whatever they want with their property.
They want to lock it all up, or they can decide they want to let it all go, just like we do with private property. If you want to lock your doors and bolt them and everything else, you can. If you want to leave it open, you can. But if you bolt your doors and put a security system and I find a way to break into it, I'm in violation of the law.
But many librarians, educators, civil libertarians, and lawyers say that represents a fundamental change in U.S. copyright law.
American copyright law was designed to fill our libraries with books.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a cultural historian at New York University and author of Copyrights and Copy Wrongs. He says the framers of the Constitution intended for copyright law to do two things: ensure that authors get paid and educate the citizens of the Republic.
We needed to be able to spread literacy, and we needed to develop a tradition. So they saw the copyright system as a way of creating enough incentive to invest in these businesses, and yet they were concerned about the public interest enough to put limits on the power of copyright. This is what's known as the copyright bargain. We, the people, grant this monopoly power to a copyright holder because we feel it's important for the copyright holder to be able to make a living. In exchange, we get something back at the end.
What we get, Vaidyanathan says, is a series of rights that temper those of copyright holders. We can parody novels, for example, or photocopy pages for research or to share with friends, or check books out of libraries. Librarian Nancy Cronick says that balance between public and private rights was upset by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, the 1998 law that she says puts all the control in the hands of publishers.
As long as the producers of information are holding all the cards, the users of information have no rights left.
Cronick says that when Congress drafted the DMCA, publishers, movie studios, and record companies were at the table to speak on behalf of private property rights, but almost no one spoke on behalf of the public. As a result, she says the law protects big-budget, high-profit movies, records, and books. But, Cronick says, when it comes to products of culture, news, and information, one size does not fit all.
We may be solving the problems for distributing Disney movies in China, but that is not necessarily solving the problems for scientists needing access to information. And that's where I think we've had a lot of conflict and tension. We've got a lot of different concerns, and we can't address them just in one way.
Nancy Cronick, Siva Vaidyanathan, and other critics of recent changes in copyright law say they're disappointed by this week's Supreme Court ruling upholding stronger copyrights. That case did not involve the DMCA, but they say it raised a number of pointed questions about that notion of balance in U.S. copyright law. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, writing for the court's 7-member majority, found that Congress is the proper venue for the setting of copyright policy, in the words of the opinion, however debatable or arguably unwise they may be. Rick Carr, NPR News.